up, though. Ilgra was her father's daughter. By his name, she swore she would have her vengeance. Two things Ulcro had proven by his attack. First, that Vermund was content to stay on Kul'Karis and sleep off his meal. Second, that the dragon was no more vulnerable to magic than he was to swords, spears, axes, or arrows. It was a disheartening realization for the Skagaro. There was talk of making weighted nets big enough to snare Vermund's wings, but the season was turning from summer to autumn, and much needed doing were they to survive the harsh mountain winter. So the Skagaro put aside their plans for killing the dragon, and though they knew it was a risk, they began the task of rebuilding their village. They built more with stone than wood this time, and it was a tiresome labor for the males, who preferred hunting or raiding or sparring among themselves to determine who was strongest. But they prevailed, and their halls rose anew. The Skagaro also dug hidden burrows throughout the foothills and stocked them well with provisions. It went against every fiber of their being to contemplate hiding like prey. The horned bow to nothing and no one, but necessity forced them to it. The younglings had to survive, and the seed stock for next year's planting too. And they set watch upon Kul'Karis at all times, night and day. Should Vermund descend again, they would have warning. Many watches Ilgra stood. When not at her post, nor hewing stone or weeding their meager crops, or tending flocks or any of the myriad tasks required of her, she devoted herself to working with her spear and learning from Arvog and the other warriors how best to fight. It was custom among the Horned for both males and females to train in the use of weapons, for theirs was a warlike people. But Ilgra pursued the practice with greater enthusiasm than most. She forsook the arts of hearth and home, much to her mother's disapproval, and spent herself in contest with the males until she could hold her own with all but the strongest. Thus the year crept past. With help from their clanmates, Ilgra and her family finished their new hall, and thereupon they set to making it a fit place to live ere the weather turned cold. And still Vermund remained perched upon Kul'Karis, lost in his gluttonous slumber. At times they heard rumblings from the mountain as the worm shifted or as he snored, knocking loose falls of ice and snow. And there were nights when fire lit the undersides of the clouds as Vermund exhaled particularly forcefully. Inevitably, the younger males began to seek to earn a name for themselves by climbing Kul'Karis and marking a spur of rock close to the dragon, without waking him. The Herndal disapproved of the practice, but their disapproval did nothing to stop it. At first, the recklessness of the climbs bothered Ilgra, but then she decided they were a help to her, for they served to accustom Vermund to the occasional visitor, if indeed he even noticed. The accounts of those who reached the summit of Kul'Karis also helped give her a sense of how she might accomplish the same. She listened with starved interest to each warrior upon his return, and in her mind she pictured the path. Imagined sneaking up on the sleeping worm. The nearest any of the males got was within a stone's throw of Vermund's wing. It was impossible to cross the final stretch of scree-strewn granite without making noise, and none of the Horned, not even the most boastful, were willing to attempt it. As for herself, Ilgra would not risk climbing Kul'Karis unless she felt sure of being able to kill grim Vermund. So she held and waited. The peace could not last, though. The whole clan knew it, and they lived with the knowledge of impending doom. and it warred upon them. At first snowfall, their nightmares came true. Vermund woke, and with a fearsome cry unfurled his wings and took to the air. He wheeled in lazy circles above the gleaming spire of Kulkaris, and then drifted down with the sound of rushing wind. The clan fled, Ilgra too, clutching Yana in one hand and Gorgoth in the other, while their mother hurried to keep up. They scattered to their burrows and sat huddled there while the dragon prowled among their halls and holdings. This time no one tried to attack Vermund. The males cursed and brandished their weapons, but they dared not break cover. The scaly old worm crept through the valley, dining upon deer and sheep and all manner of animals. However, he ate little compared with before, and set only one small fire in the fields by the streams. Then Vermund licked his chops with a tongue that was barbed like that of a cat. Seemingly satisfied, he returned to the air, and after several more lazy circles, settled once again on Kulkaris. He released a single huff of smoke, tucked his snout under his tail, and closed his crimson eyes. Unbelieving, Ilgra crawled out of her burrow. None of the clan had been hurt, and the animals they had lost were not enough to starve them. The Herndal consulted, and then Elga nodded and said, "This we can endure." And so it was. Enduring was not to Ilgra's taste, nor to any of the Skagaros, but it was better than being eaten. Winter aged into spring, spring into summer, and then summer again to winter. The clan hunted and farmed and mated, and once more grew strong. Far above, Vermund was a black blight upon the crown of Kulkaris, a looming menace often seen and often spoken of, but rarely an immediate threat. As they grew accustomed to his presence, the Skagaro came to view Vermund as more a part of the landscape than a living creature. To them he was no different from a force of nature, a blizzard or a plague that might strike without warning and that, for the most part, was best ignored. If asked, the Skagaro would claim they still wished to kill the dragon, and in evenings they often twisted cord for the much-discussed nets. But the yardage needed was far more than they could make in any reasonable period of time, and the nets remained unrealized. True it was, Vermund sometimes roused himself and came flying down amid fire and fury to steal from their herds, and if any of the clan were foolish enough to challenge him, the dragon would eat them too. Yet Vermund's attacks were not the most important part of their lives. Wood still needed chopping, livestock still needed guarding against wolves and bears and sharp-eyed mountain cats. Crops still needed tending. The daily duties necessary to survival took precedence. And Ilgra hated it. Complacency rankled her to no end. Her blood called for vengeance, and every moment of delay was a frustration. Worse, there were some within the clan who began to speak of Vermund in reverent tones, as if he were worthy of respect. Several times, while herding flocks from one pasture to the next, Ilgra found small shrines in the foothills of Kulkaris, shrines with offerings of food and drink meant for the devouring worm. She destroyed them all. Had she known who built them, she would have beaten them with Gorgoth until they were bruised from head to heel. Ilgra kept at her training, and her strength and skill continued to grow. Sparring with Arvag was no preparation for fighting the dragon, but because of it she felt increasingly confident in her abilities. The day of Hroshtham came late that winter, and upon its coming the trials of passage, wherein Ilgra had to stand before the whole of the clan and prove her courage. Despite her fear, she held her place, and reaching the end, the dams marked her as a full member of Clan Skagaro. But the trials were very hard. They were supposed to be. It was 7 days before Ilgro was recovered enough to leave her hall, and 3 moons after that before the wounds on her chest had healed. Ilgro wore the scars as the badge of honor they were, and she wished her father had been there to see, for she knew he would have been proud. Not once had she cried out during the whole ordeal, not once. With the trials complete, and her skills with Gorgoth well advanced, Ilgro finally felt ready to pair action with intent. Yet she bided her time a while longer, until winter broke, and most of the snowy cap melted off High Kulkaris's brow. Then one evening, when the air was mild and the fields were green, she filled a pouch with unguent for burns, and with berries and cheese, and dried strips of meat. She sharpened Gorgoth once more, so it could cut a strand of hair with the slightest touch, and she brushed and cleaned her leather armor, oiled it, so it gleamed by the hall fire. She said nothing of her plans to her mother or sister, only kissed each on the forehead, before retiring to bed. When the birds first sounded in the grey before dawn, Ilgro rose and slipped from the hall, and in the coolness of morning, turned to face Kulkaris. None marked her passing as she snuck through the village, not even Rajak, the male on watch. When she reached the forest edge, Ilgro quickened her pace, heading toward the ridge of earth and stone that would allow her to climb Kulkaris's flank. It was the same path the shaman Ulcro had followed, and the knowledge gave her a moment of pause. Still, an expanding sense of excitement filled Ilgra's heart, and she moved forward with light steps, glad to at last be taking action. Despite Ulcro's failure, and that of Arvog's warband before, Ilgra felt sure she could succeed where they had failed. The reasons for her confidence were simple. She was not going to attempt to match Vermund in open combat. Though Ilgro was willing to risk her life in pursuit of vengeance, she was not willing to throw it away in a hopeless gambit. And she had become convinced that Arvog's warband had failed in their quest because of the noise the 7 warriors had made on the rock face. The lone males who had ascended Kulkaris had managed to avoid attracting Vermund's attention. Thuswise, Ilgro felt she could do the same. By herself, she could be quiet in a way no group of horned could, and she had other means of avoiding detection besides. Then it would just be a matter of a quick thrust of Gorgoth beneath Vermund's armored eyelid, and the dragon would die. The thrust would need to be long to reach the worm's brain, but Ilgro had no doubt that with the memory of her father guiding her arm, she could hit her mark. When she came upon a small stream that poured out of the ground and down a mossy gully, she stopped to fill her skins. As she held them beneath the icy water, she breathed deep, enjoying the smell of the stream and the peaceful sound of water burbling over wood and stone. For she knew it might be the last time she would savor such a simple pleasure. Onward she forged, through brake and bramble, up rise and ridge, across saddle and scarp, until the village was a shrunken cluster below, as tiny as a youngling's toys. Often outcroppings of rock blocked the way, and Ilgro had to climb from one precarious hold to another, knowing that if her hands slipped, she might lose her life. The sun beat hot throughout the day, and sweat gathered upon her brow and dripped into her eyes so they stung. She ate while walking, but sparingly, not wanting her stomach to be heavy with food. So steep was Kulkaris that for most of the ascent, the mountain hid the bulk of Vermund from her sight. She could hear the dragon, though, snorting and growling in his sleep, and when he shifted his weight, the bones of the mountain groaned, and birds flew in fright from the boughs of the trees. Eventually and inevitably, Vermund came into sight, first a section of his tail extending over the side of Kulkaris like a great black cliff, sharp and jagged, then a fold of wing, thicker than any hide and laced with pulsing veins the width of her legs. And last of all, the huge, white claws of one forefoot, curved, saw-toothed, and cruelly pointed, and above, the dragon's wedge-shaped head, partially covered by a length of tail. A heavy odor clung to the worm, a sour musk that reminded her of the den of a large cat. It was a warning scent, the scent of an eater of flesh. Ilgra stopped at the first distant glimpse of Vermund and made her final preparations. She tied rags around her feet that they might not betray her with unwanted sound, and she poured water onto the sparse earth and smeared herself with mud to hide her own scent. Were she hunting deer, she would have used pine needles or chokeweed, but so high on the mountain only moss and lichen grew. She finished by rubbing her skin with a mat of wool she had hung over the hearth in their hall so as to gather the scent of smoke. The worm so often spouted smoke from his nostrils, she felt sure he had long since ceased to smell it. Then Ilgra gathered her courage and resumed her climb, only slower and more careful than before. When sometime later she gained a clear view of Vermund's head, she froze, and her heart redoubled in pace. For she saw a slit of red in Vermund's eye, and she realized he slept with the armored lid partially open. She studied the mountaintop. The stone was rotten and split in heavy slabs. Deep scratches scored the surface, and scales big as both her hands lay scattered among the pieces of scree, while patches of unmelted snow filled the shadowed hollows. Near the dragon's folded wing, Ilgra spotted the flat-faced boulder marked with the sigils of those warriors who had reached the summit. Careful not to disturb the loose-strewn rock, Ilgra edged around the dragon, always keeping a slab of stone between her and the crimson eye. If she could get close enough, she could strike before the worm had a chance to react. Even if she failed in killing him, she would still half-blind him, and he would be disadvantaged forevermore. She whispered a prayer to her father and to Rana, Queen of the Gods, and by them she bolstered her courage. The thinness of the air made her want to gasp. The strength of her anticipation sped her pulse. Every muscle in her body was strung taut in readiness for action. Tremors of nervous excitement racked her steps. Already she could feel the frenzy of battle rage, the great boon and bane of her people rising within her, and she bared her teeth with feral glee. Near an hour passed before Ilgra finally maneuvered herself behind a slab within striking distance of Vermud's enormous head. She stayed crouched there while she calmed her breathing and readied her spirit. Should she die, it would be a glorious death, and the clan would sing her name for generations to come. She touched the horn of her father where it hung on her hip. She wished she could wind it, but she dared not lose the advantage of surprise. Every chance of success rested upon it. Ilgra took a breath. Then she vaulted over the slab and ran headlong toward the dragon, spear held high. Three quick steps, and she drove her weapon toward the narrow slit of Vermund's sleeping eye. The dragon blinked. With a loud ping, the blade of the spear shattered against Vermund's scaled lid, and the haft bounced back in Ilgra's hands, numbing her palms. She stumbled to a stop. For a brief moment, she stood motionless, dumbfounded, The lid lifted. A blazing red-rimmed eye stared down at her, the pupil a black crevice large enough to walk through. The eye filled the sky. It dominated her existence, pinning her in place with palpable force. Then the dragon's mind enveloped her own, and Ilgra shrank before the vast and incomprehensible nature of its intelligence. From it she felt not surprise nor anger, nor even amusement, but the worst of all reactions, indifference. Her sense of self faltered beneath the withering onslaught of Velmund's presence. The world seemed to tilt around her, and darkness yawned wide with a hungry grin, and all she knew and all she was became no more important than a mote of dust, adrift in an endless void. Fury freed Ilgra of the dragon's dangerous hold, and she reached for her father's horn as she backed away. She could endure many things from the worm, but not indifference, never that. If it was the last thing she did, she would shake Velmund from his apathy and force him to respond as was proper, force him to respect her. That much she and her clan was owed. Ilgra lifted the horn to her lips, about to give voice to her outrage, when the scree betrayed her. Her foot slipped on a loose piece of rock, and she fell tumbling backward off the barren ridge atop proud Kulkaris. She flailed and lost her grip on Gorgoth. Finding no purchase, she pulled the horn against her belly, holding it close as sky and mountain spun in a dizzying circle. Icy snow broke against her, and then brush and branches until, with a jolt so violent, her vision flashed white and a spangle of stars obscured her sight. Ilgra fetched up against the twisted trunk of a wind-warped fir. Like all the Horned, Ilgra had a thick skin, as thick as that of a winter boar. It protected her from many wounds, but it could not protect her from the worst. When her breath returned in sudden gasps and she strove to move, Ilgra discovered her leg was broken, and she cried out with pain. Her spear was nowhere to be seen. She lay there for a hopeless while, staring toward the peak, waiting for Velmund to crawl down the face of Kulkaris and devour her. She could neither run, nor fight, nor hide. So Ilgra did what was only sensible, and held still to conserve her strength. But Velmund never appeared. It seemed she was entirely unimportant so far as the dragon was concerned. The realization aggravated Ilgra nearly as much as her broken leg. It wasn't right the worm should have so much power over their lives, the very power of life and death, and yet to him, they were no more than scurrying mice. Ilgra snarled and pulled herself upright, though the effort nearly caused her to again cry out. She clung to the tree as a drowning swimmer clings to the slightest hold, and waited while the torment of her leg slowly subsided. She checked her father's horn, the strap still knotted round her fist, and was gladdened to see it well and whole. As Ilgra readied to move, she spotted a glint of brilliant blue in the nearby scrub. Curious, she dropped to hands and knees and crawled closer, each touch of leg to ground sending a lance of pain through her body. She parted the scrub with her hands, and there among the knotted stems saw the staff of Ulcro, the shaman. Wonder overcame her, for the wood appeared untouched by the mountain's harsh climb. Ilgra took the staff then, and as she held it before her, she decided if she could not best Velmund by strength of limb, she would have to best him with less honest means, with spells and spirits and the twisting of words. The thought frightened her, but Ilgra had never been one to let fear win out. Then she named the staff as she had named her spear. Gorgoth, or Revenge. She crawled back to the fir, cut a branch, and with a strip torn from her tunic, bound it to her broken leg. Then, using the staff as a crutch, she began the long climb back down Kulkaris to the valley floor. It was a miserable ordeal. Every step hurt, and ere long Ilgra's throat grew dry, and the ache of hunger hollowed out her stomach, for she had lost her food and water in the fall. She stopped often to rest her leg, and it was deep into the gloaming when the orange light of the first hall appeared twinkling between the branches of the trees, a welcome sight, for it promised warmth and safety and good food. Arvag and Moktar found her before she reached the hall. They greeted her with cries of relief and looked with wonder at the staff she bore. The two had been waiting for her since morn. As Arvag explained, when it became known she had departed, it took but a short while before they found her spoor and tracked her to the base of Kulkaris. None dared follow past that point, for fear of what Vermund might do if she roused the dragon. But they had kept watch, in hope she would return.
"Your mother is much worried," said Arvag in his low rumble.
Ilgra nodded. She had expected nothing else. They carried her back home. There her mother and sister descended upon Ilgra with a concern fierce enough to give even Vermund, evil as he was, pause. And yet Ilgra could tell, despite the cuffs and accusations, that her mother was proud. What Ilgra had done was a feat equal to those of the bravest warriors. And while she had not succeeded in killing the dragon, she had retrieved a great treasure in Ulcro's staff. Yana, too, seemed proud, and she said, "Were I grown into my horns, I would have gone with you, Ilgra's sister. You did what I cannot yet do, and for that I am glad." Then her mother said, "You are finished now, yes. You have satisfied the demands of honor. You will not attempt any more foolishness." But Ilgra's discontent remained. So long as Vermund lived, she could not rest easy. Only the blood of the dragon could slake her thirst for vengeance. She made to say as much, but the arrival of the healer ended the conversation. A leather belt was fit between Ilgra's teeth, and she bit down while the bone in her leg was pulled straight and set. She made no sound, but stared at the ceiling, and thought of the staff and all she needed to learn. For Ilgra was young, and yet undaunted. A leg healed badly. She had further damaged it during her descent from Kulkaris, and the bone knit with a bend, so that forever after she walked with a limp, as the one leg was shorter than the other. It hurt, too, in damp and cold, and after walks, but Ilgra never let the discomfort prevent her from going where she wanted. One thing was certain, however, her days as a warrior had reached their end. Her balance was poor, and if some foe struck her crippled leg, it would give way and was like to break again. The knowledge was a bitter drop upon her tongue. Ilgra found her thoughts wandering down unaccustomed paths, dark and tangled. At times she would remember the feel of Vermund's mind, and then the world seemed to grow dim and distant, and she would have to sit until the sensation passed. Despite her leg, Ilgra grew ever taller. By autumn it was clear she was anointed, as was her father before, and one by one the males came courting. Those she could not ignore she beat about the head and shoulders with Gorgoth, and so chased them away, for the clan feared the staff and the magics it contained. Her mother and sister disapproved, but Ilgra had no desire to take a mate. Such would only distract from her larger goal. She said nothing of her intent, though, and merely claimed no male had done enough to win her favor. That was, for the moment, enough to quell their concern. What time she had of her own, Ilgra spent in study with the staff, attempting to learn its secrets. but her efforts bore no fruit. She knew not the ways of Wirding, and whatever powers the staff possessed, set there by Ulcro himself, remained a mystery. Her lack of progress became an ever greater source of discontent. Ilgra could hardly sleep at nights for thinking about the riddle the staff presented. At last, late in the season, she decided her only hope of success lay in seeking out a mentor who might instruct her in magic. The thought of leaving the valley pained her greatly, but doing nothing was a still greater torment. For once, fortune smiled upon her. Just as Ilgra began her preparations, another shaman arrived at the village, and his name was Khorjard Stonefist. To him, Ilgra showed the staff and confessed her desire to learn the Wirding arts. But Khorjard scoffed and made claim on the staff by right of his chosen craft. Ilgra laughed at his claim, and the clan laughed with her. No outlander could tell the Skagaro what spoils were theirs to keep, not even a shaman. Then Khorjard locked horns with her, and laughter turned to threats, and it was only with much wrestling and shouting that they reached a compromise that dissatisfied them both, this being the hallmark of all good compromises. What they settled upon was a wager, a full round of Magra, 3 games of 3. Should Ilgra win, Khorjard would take her as apprentice and teach her his secret knowledge. And should Khorjard win, Ilgra would surrender the staff. And that would be the end of the matter. Though surprised by Ilgra's challenge, her mother did not object. To be a shaman was to be a person of importance. It would bring honor to their family. Moreover, any clan lucky enough to have a spellweaver of their own was all but guaranteed to survive the winter. The contest was held that evening. The whole village gathered in Arvog's hall to watch. Ilgra and Khorjard sat with lowered horns one across from the other, and the polished table of bone between. 9 games in total they played, 9, as was the sacred number. Ilgra won Beater, the first set of 3, and Khorjard won Biter, the second set. This was no more than Ilgra had expected. When it came to Breaker, the 3rd and final set, Ilgra knew she had the upper horn. Breaker could be won either by attacking your opponent or by fleeing before them and so catching them in a trap of your own making. Like most warriors, Khorjard was too proud to flee, but for herself, Ilgra no longer had any pride. She only cared to win. So she broke, and by breaking, won. Khorjard cursed her, but a wager was a wager, and he to his pledged word was true. At morn's first light, Ilgra met the shaman in an empty meadow along the shadowed edge of the forest. And there it was, she began her apprenticeship. For 3 moons, Ilgra labored under the instruction of Khorjard. He was a cruel and uncompromising tutor, but Ilgra minded not. She wanted to learn, and she was willing to drive herself far beyond the bounds of comfort. And learn she did. Khorjard taught her the rules of Wirding, and of the ancient language used to reshape the world according to one's will. He showed Ilgra how to govern her thoughts and feelings, and how to touch the minds of others, even as Vermund had done with hers. When by herself, Ilgra strove to memorize the names and words Khorjard saw fit to share with her, words of power that spoke to the true nature of things. Her mother and the clan as a whole freed Ilgra of all but the most basic responsibilities, so she could devote herself to study. She did not tell them of her greater goal, though, not even her family, preferring to keep it clasped close to her heart. At the end of the 3 moons, Khorjard Stonefist departed. He was at heart a wanderer, and there were other clans, clans without shamans, that needed his services. Ere he left, he gave Ilgra a list of tasks, skills to master, words to practice, tools to make. Also, too, a list of prohibitions, things she was not to do, foremost of which was any weirding that broke the laws of nature, and second, any weirding with Ulgro's staff. While he was gone, Ilgra was consistent with her practice. She strove to excel that she might surprise Khorjad upon his return, and so she might accomplish her greater goal all the sooner. For the longest time, Ilgra felt as if she were butting her head against stone. Nothing about weirding came easily, but she persisted. And just as Horn grows too slowly to notice from day to day, and yet after a span of months, the changes are plain to see, so too did Ilgra's understanding progress. The weirding felt strange to Ilgra. She was ill-accustomed to using word or thought to force a change. At first it seemed a cheat, but the weirding exacted a price of effort in proportion to the ambition of her intent, and the price comforted Ilgra, assured her that she was still a member of the Horned, and not a spirit or a god. She was still bound to the earth and the trees, and the reality of life itself. Khorjad returned at the end of harvest, and Ilgra showed him all she had accomplished. If the shaman was impressed, he did not say, only worked her harder, gave her more tasks, ones that forced her well past the limits of her abilities. Again Khorjad stayed some few moons, and then again he left to resume his wandering. In like manner, Ilgra's apprenticeship continued. As moons gathered into seasons, and then seasons into years, Ilgra learned many things. She learned the true names of the deer and the bears, and all the birds and beasts of the mountains. Also, too, the plants, be they ever so large or small. And she learned how to speak to the wind, and the earth, and the flames of the fire, and how to coax them into doing her bidding. The riddle of steel became hers, and the secrets of binding and warding and making. In time, Khorjad taught her the truth about her staff, no longer Ulcro's, now hers. The sapphire set within the end contained a great storehouse of power that broke and battered like a wildling sea against its sharp-edged prison. Should that prison fail, the sea would rush forth in a torrent and destroy all who were near. But if the shaman who wielded the staff were wise, they could harness the power to their will and use it to accomplish great feats, feats that one person alone could not hope to otherwise accomplish. The power was not to be squandered, though. It was a treasure more valuable than the stone itself, a gleaming hoard that Ulcro and his master before him had gathered over the course of their lifetimes. The power was to be husbanded against moments of rare need, and between those, Ilgra should add to it herself, nurture it, feed it with the strength of her body, so the hoard might grow to even greater size, and she might pass it on in turn. And Ilgra understood. The power was a legacy. But she had no intention of preserving it, and for that, she felt guilty. Twice she accompanied Khorjad on his wanderings. She had never left the valley of the Skagaro before, and the sight of new mountains both excited and unsettled her, and the clans they visited had unfamiliar customs that oft-times made her feel less than half-welcome. Still, the travel was useful, and she was grateful for the experiences, for they revealed to her the true size of the world. More than that, they strengthened her love and appreciation of home. The valley contained every good thing a clan needed, clean water, plentiful game, trees and stone for building. The only fault it had was Vermund. If she could but remove him, their home would again be as it should. In those years, Vermund's lengths of slumber were unpredictable, but the clan grew familiar with his attacks, and of them, few surprises came. As long as they kept their distance and angered not the worm, they could expect to survive. There were exceptions, accidents on their part, sometimes malice on Vermund's, but the exceptions were rare enough to bear. None of which Ilgr could accept with any good grace, and Vermund's presence remained a hard lump stuck in her throat. Then one day, a neighboring clan, the clan Invik, came raiding. It happened in late summer, when the fields were full and the animals fattened. The Invik surprised them at the height of the midday sun. With whoops and bellows and wild cries, the Invex warriors charged out of the forest, shaking spears and hammers and poles with woven pennants, displaying family crests. Such raids were common among the clans. They were a good way for males to test themselves and win a name sufficient to attract a mate. For the most part, the raids were, while not entirely friendly, not entirely hostile. Blood would be shed, but rare it was that a member of either clan lost their life. In this case, a raid upon the Skagaru would be considered an opportunity to capture an outsized share of glory, seeing as how they lived beneath the shadow of a dragon. Already, their clan had acquired a reputation for bravery far beyond the norm. So it was that when the raid occurred, Ilgr deemed it more an exciting distraction than a serious threat. She ran from her family's rebuilt hall and joined the clan in beating back the intruders. As always, the males took the lead, but it was a group effort. All but the younglings were honor-bound to participate. Even the oldest of the Herndal took up arms, mainly canes and reed brooms, which stung like hornets. While Ilgr shook her staff at a bewildered Invik, she watched with admiration as Arvag grappled with the largest of the attacking warriors and beat him to the ground. Then another Invik charged over and tried to seize her. She was anointed, after all, and much prized on that account, and Ilgr struck him with Gorgoth, and with a weirding word set Swampfire on the tips of his horns. The greenish flames held no heat, but the Invex shrieked a most unseemly sound and fled, panic-struck, toward the nearest stream, batting at his burning horns the whole while. And Ilgr was much amused. The sounds of their contest rang loud in the noonday air, the clanging of wood and iron, the bellows and shouts of the males, the curses and exhortations of the females, and the outraged bleating of the livestock. The clamor was loud enough, it seemed, that it reached all the way to the lofty peak of High Kulkaris. For amid their fighting, Ilgr heard a warning shout, and she turned to see Vermund the Grim lifting his head from its stony pillow. The dragon peered toward the valley floor, and their fighting ceased, as Vermund uttered a rolling, rumbling, avalanche-inducing growl. The growl was so powerful, Ilgr felt it in her feet and in her bones. The surface of the ground blurred with vibration. Animals cowered, streams rippled, and the air darkened as flocks of screaming birds fled the forest. Atop Kulkaris, slabs of ice and snow cleaved from the granite peak and fell with soft thunder into the ranks of trees below, snapping their hoary trunks like stalks of dry straw. The worm's meaning could not have been any clearer. Then Vermund lowered his head, closed his eyes, and appeared to sink back into sleep. The Invek paled and put away their weapons. Without another word, they fled back whence they came, taking with them neither mates nor livestock, nor trophies, nor glory itself. and Ilgra crossed her arms and glared at the distant dragon. That he felt possessive of his private food stocks did nothing to lessen her hate. After 4 full years of instruction, Khorzhad Stonefist announced that there was nothing more he could teach her. Indeed, Ilgra had already surpassed him in mastery of weirding. But as he cautioned her, mastery did not always imply wisdom. Ilgra thanked him, for she was grateful for his tutelage, and she had grown fond of the ill-tempered shaman over the years. Then Khorzhad took her by the horns and said, "I know the ambition that lies in your heart, Ilgra Lamefoot. Well, I understand it. Once I had a mate, a strong, fierce-horned, not unlike yourself. But one spring, she chanced upon a bear that had woken from its winter slumber. It was mean and hungry, and it attacked her. I found her still alive, but all my years of study, all my skill and knowledge, were not enough to save her." "Is that why you wander?" Ilgra asked. Khorzhad nodded, and still he held her horns. "The bear was a lone male, without a territory of its own. I set out to track it and kill it, but never did I find it. And since that day, more than a score of years has now passed."
"Then why not return home?"
The shaman smiled. It was the first true smile she had seen of him. "Because there are others in the world who need helping, and to help is a great good and a better use of my life. It is not the way of our people, Ilgra, but my counsel is this. Abandon your quest for vengeance ere it destroys you. The dragon outstrips us all. You are strong and clever, and you care for our kind. It would be a sorrow to lose you to a rash adventure that kills so many of our young warriors." Ilgra was silent as she thought upon his words. Then she said, "Your counsel means much to me, Khorzhad, and I thank you for it. But I cannot forget my father, and I cannot abandon my quest."
"Did I say you should forget? I shall not argue with you on this, Ilgra. Only think well on what you do. You have been a good apprentice of mine. No matter your chosen path, you have my blessing. May the gods grant you good fortune, and may you always be of sharp mind and clear conscience." Then Khorzhad released her horns and once more departed. And Ilgra knew he would not soon return. Now confident of her abilities, Ilgra set to work with eager desire. For she had a plan. The dragon was a creature of fire, and if that fire could be extinguished, then might Vermund be killed. And how best to snuff out a fire but with the cleansing force of water? For 3 days she walked the valley fringe, searching for the place that might best serve her. All dissatisfied her, until at last she thought of the pool where she used to swim, the selfsame pool where she had watched Vermund's dread arrival. The pool itself was too small for her purpose, but the overspill poured into a deep and winding ravine with walls of stone, moisture blackened and green spotted with mosses, lichens, and hanging tendrils that put forth pale flowers in spring's early days. If the ravine were blocked at its narrowest point, a great store of water would build up behind the blockage. And should that store break loose, woe betide any caught in the water's path. They would be trapped between the stony walls, beaten and bashed, and battered beyond saving.
It was a thought most pleasing. Yet still, Ildra kept her plans to herself. Although uncertain of their success, she saw no merit in debate or discussion. Nothing could turn her aside from her chosen path. Besides, the outrush of water would pose little danger to the Skogaru. The ravine and the stream sat some distance south of their village, and like the other streams nestled among the folds of the mountains, fed into the Hraluk River that ran north to south along the valley floor, from conquered Kulkaris to distant, saw-toothed Ulvavik that marked the limit of the clan's holdings. But there were problems to be solved. How to build the blockage, and once it was built, how best to lure Vermund the Grim into the ravine? In autumn, the clan would trap geese by digging narrow, sloping trenches that they baited with suet. The geese would follow the bait, unsuspecting, and find themselves caught in the deep end of the trenches, unable to spread their wings and fly. Goose or dragon? The principle was the same. Ildra wasted no time in putting plan to action. First, she left her family's hall and raised herself a small hut on the crest of the ravine. This occasioned much argument with her mother, who felt it wrong of Ildra to remove herself from the daily doings of the village. "It is not good," she said. "Not for you and not for us." But Ildra insisted, and her departure became a festering sore between them. As for the rest of the Skogaru, they accepted Ildra's removal without question. The weavers of spells were seen as separate from the normal strand of the Horned, and strangeness of behavior was expected of them. Once ensconced in her hut, alone with the wind and the howls of wandering wolves, Ildra began her work. Speaking words of power, she carved a path through the dirt and thus diverted the overspill from the spring-fed pool into a channel alongside the lip of the ravine. With the stream coursing along a new path, she was then free to descend into the rocky cleft below, without having to contend with the flow of water. All that summer and autumn, Ildra labored to dam up the ravine at the point where the stone walls stood closest, a pinched gap no wider than twice the full span of her arms. Though her leg was not fit for fighting, she was anointed, and like all anointed, strong. She toiled mightily, and by dint of her efforts filled the gap with boulders carried from high on the mountain side. As each boulder dropped into place, Ildra bound it with weirding to the rocks below, welding them one to another, so they formed a single, solid whole. And when the final piece was placed, she returned the overspill to its normal course, and the water began to gather behind the stone blockade. Yet the feed of water was slight. It would take many months to fill the apportioned ravine. In the meantime, the bed of the stream lay dry below, a pebbled snake, now grey and dead. When the Skogaru noticed her labours, they questioned her. Ildra merely claimed that she wanted to make a larger pool for swimming, and the clan did not see fit to challenge her word, ascribing her actions to the expected eccentricities of a shaman. But while her explanation satisfied the rest of the clan, it did not satisfy her mother, who said, "You never do anything without purpose, Ildra daughter. Tell me truly, what is it you want?" Then it was Ildra's loneliness proved her undoing. A moment of weakness overcame her, a desire for much missed closeness with those she loved. And in that moment of weakness,
she confessed her secret desire. The confession greatly angered her mother, and she said, "This is why you have kept yourself apart, Ilgra daughter. It is head sickness. It is dog-bite fever. The dragon cannot be killed. If ever he leaves, it will be of his own choice, and not because of anything we have done." To which Ilgra said, "That I cannot accept. I will either kill Vermund or he will kill me. No other outcome is possible." Her mother gnashed her teeth. "Why must you be so troublesome? Some things there are we cannot change. There is no glory in fighting the inevitable, do you not understand? I understand that the worm killed my father, who was your bloodmate. You would leave him and the rest of our clanmates unavenged. Well, not I." Then Ilgra's mother locked horns with her, though the difference in their height was so great as to make Ilgra bend nearly in half. "I honored my mate, and I cared for our children," said her mother, a growl in her voice. "There was no glory in getting myself slain that you might grow up alone in the world." At that, understanding broke Ilgra's anger, and she bared her throat. "You are right. I meant no disrespect." Her mother lifted her horns as well. A softness entered her expression. "You are a good daughter to me, Ilgra, and a good sister to Yana. But please, give up this fruitless quest. It will bring you nothing but sorrow." "I cannot." "You are determined? You will spend your life in this manner despite my counsel?"
"I am."
And her mother sighed. "Then I must give you my blessing, in the hope it may prove a shield against misfortune." And she did so, and they embraced. And Ilgra felt her eyes fill with tears. Early next morning, Ilgra came out of her hut to find Yana standing upon the side of the ravine, staring at Ilgra's handiwork below. Said her sister, "You still mean to avenge our father?" It was not a question. To which Ilgra said, "Yes." Then Yana looked at her with fierce eyes. "Good. Were I as strong as you, I would do likewise. You are anointed, but I am not. You know the ways of Weirding, but I do not. And you have no fear, Ilgra sister. I wish the same were true for me." "I do fear," said Ilgra, "but it does not stop me." Then she wrapped Yana in her arms, and it comforted Ilgra to know her sister supported her and shared her desire to stop Vermund. Her family said nothing to the rest of the Skagaro of Ilgra's intent, and for that Ilgra was grateful. But thereafter she felt more alone than ever, for the weight of Yana's expectations added to her own, and the voice of the wind seemed to acquire a mocking tone. While she waited for the ravine to fill, she focused her energies on her duties as shaman to the Skagaro. Mainly this involved helping with births, healing what hurt she could, and setting spells upon various tools as a guard against breakage or other mishap. A shaman's responsibilities were of a more tangible sort than those of the Herndal, who, along with leading the clan, oversaw the mysteries of auguries and portents, as well as all matters pertaining to the gods. It was for the best. Despite her use of Weirding, Ilgra preferred to deal with things that she could touch, things that were real. The Horned, she assisted, often gave her gifts in return. The saving of a life was no small thing, after all. By such means,
Ilgra soon acquired a small herd of sheep and goats, and one disgruntled bristleback boar. She penned the animals within the ravine.